Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, Robin Hood Radio's very own critic who joins us weekly, the films The Cleanse, 24 Frames, and Love, Cecil. Love, Jill. Hi, David. No, that's wrong. Hi, David. Love, Jill.
There you go. I love you, Jill. And I love everybody this morning. What the heck?
Oh, my
Except
God.
I'm afraid I don't love the first movie that I'm going to talk about here. I just wanted to touch on it briefly. This week I want to talk about three of the sort of smaller movies that are not playing at multiplexes. Of course, I do this quite a lot, but in recent times we've talked about movies like Incredibles 2 and Black Panther and so forth. So I always like to balance those big blockbuster extravaganza tentpole type pictures with, you know, by paying attention to smaller things that are around. And The Cleanse, written and directed by Bobby Miller, is whatever else it is. It is a very, very small movie. And it's a kind of an inventive movie, but I really don't think it works. And I just wanted to comment on it a little bit. It deals with a kind of an interesting subject. It's about an unhappy young man. He's lonely in his life. And he runs across an advertisement, and he goes off to a retreat, which is going to help him to cleanse his life. That's where the title comes from. To cleanse his soul, to cleanse his mind, and to get a whole new start in everything. And so he goes off to this retreat, which turns out to be run by a couple played by the wonderful Angelica Houston and the also wonderful Oliver Platt, although he doesn't show up until quite late in the movie. And, you know, it's never quite sure whether these people and this place has anything legitimate to offer or whether it's all just some sort of a scam or whatever it is. But in any case, our young, discontented with life hero, whose name is Paul, goes there. And there are a handful of other people. There are a young woman who he finds attractive and a couple who are there together. As the thing goes on, it becomes very much a kind of a – it's a fantasy film. It is not in any way a realistic film. And it turns out that they are instructed to drink all of these apparently abominably horrible and not just unpalatable but almost unconsumable concoctions, and eventually things start coming out of them, another meaning of the word cleanse, and eventually some of the stuff that's coming out of them, I won't go into detail on that, turns into little creatures. And these little creatures sort of live in sort of the corners of their cabins where they're staying at this retreat. And the little creatures are adorable, visually, cinematically. They're just cute little creatures with big, soulful eyes. And then we discover later on in the film that they are actually embodiments of all the bad stuff that has come out of these people at the retreat. And eventually the people are supposed to kill these creatures in order to complete the cleanse. And this is a very, very strange conceit for a film to have. If they're bad, okay, it's interesting to make them look adorable. But to actually, then we're supposed to have them be killed and the main characters can't bring themselves to do this, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the whole movie is full of interesting sort of little concepts that don't work. And ultimately, I just found the movie very off-putting. Its major virtue is that it's only about an hour and 20 minutes long, and take off the credits, and it's even shorter than that. But I just didn't feel it worked. I didn't feel the acting was very good. I would like to very much to see Angelica Houston and Oliver Platt do major stuff in the movies again, but this ain't it. So I just wanted to touch bases with it, pay a little bit of attention to it, and say in this case, we have a very sort of quirky, independent experiment that I think does not quite work. 24 Frames, the next movie I'd like to talk about, is a quirky independent experiment that really, really very much does work, although it is a very, very unconventional film. I was noticing today a viewer comment on IMDb, and somebody thought it was so bad that it couldn't possibly be the work of Abbas Kiarostami, who was the credited director. Well, it's not only the work of Abbas Kiarostami, it's an absolute consummation of a whole lot of things that he worked for during the whole last part of his career, and he worked on this film very, very hard for a very long time. So it's very much his work. So Abbas Kiarostami was a just profoundly great Iranian filmmaker. He died just a couple of years ago in his middle 70s, a very sad thing. I knew Abbas a little bit. I interviewed him once. Anybody who wants to find out more about him can look up an interview I did with him for Film Comment a number of years ago, which is very easily available on the web. And Abbas Kiarostami was an Iranian filmmaker, and like many Iranian filmmakers who emerged when he did, which was he started his work back in the 70s, really. There's a lot of censorship in Iranian cinema, and in order to get around that, a whole lot not to get around it, but a way of sort of coping with that situation. Some of the very, very great Iranian filmmakers, not just Kiarostami but others, made movies that centered largely on children. A way of dealing with very important issues in the human condition without getting into the kind of adult problems that sometimes lead to censorship. Kiarostami also had censorship problems too, but he made a number of films that focused primarily on children. He also made a number of documentaries. And then when he moved into the major phase of his career, which was in the 80s, he made three movies that took place in a region called Koker in Iran, which suffered from a terrible earthquake. And he made some fiction films, but they veer over into nonfiction as well. They're kind of interesting blends, very much shot on location, some of which deal directly or indirectly with this horrible earthquake. Maybe his most famous movie is a film called Taste of Cherry, which is about a man who wants to commit suicide. This did run into censorship problems with the Iranian government. But a thing about Kiarostami, he made these, again, a number of documentaries and a number of, by the way, what I think is probably his greatest film, I just want to mention the title, called The Wind Will Carry Us, which he made in the very end of the 90s. He was a very, very subtle filmmaker, and his movies have a tremendous visual impact, particularly those movies that take place in the Koker region of Iran that deal directly or in some cases indirectly with that earthquake. Astounding landscapes, astounding places where the stories take place and that the characters move through. So his movies often had a tremendous amount of just sheer visual impact, never fancy impact, never the kind of fast-cutting stuff that we get in today's Hollywood films, but just a sort of visual majesty. At the same time, however, he was very much a minimalist. And I would say that through all of his fiction films, the most common kind of methodology that he enjoyed using was to have shots of people driving and talking in their cars. He really loved this. I talked to him about this. He felt that, first of all, people tend to unburden themselves. When you're driving a car and there's somebody next to you, you're not looking directly at them. They're not looking directly at you. You feel freer to say things. And then also outside the car window, you can have some of those landscapes I was just talking about. So he loved to have shots, scenes, sequences of people driving in cars and talking to each other. So this is the minimalist side of his sensibility. And in the early 2000s, he really moved very much in this direction. He made a movie simply entitled 10, which consists of 10 sequences. It's a fiction film, it's a dramatic film, but it consists entirely of unmoving camera in a car, focusing on people in the car. Mostly a woman who is driving the car, and then also her many passengers who change over the course of the film. Then that was 2002. A year later, he made a movie that was even more minimalist called Five, dedicated to Ozu, dedicated to the towering Japanese filmmaker Yasujiro Ozu, which is basically a series of five short sequences. Well, they're not so short. The movie's well over an hour long, but five sequences that simply show some situation in nature, and we watch it, and we contemplate it, and we think about it, and it's framed meticulously, carefully by him, and there are events that happen within these frames, although they're not dramatic events in the usual sense, and it's just really quite a remarkable movie. So one might think that you can't get minimalism too much beyond 10 sequences with an unmoving camera in a car, or five sequences showing still scenes in nature. After that, he went to France and he made a number of movies there in the last years before his death, more conventional type, well, not conventional, none of his films were conventional, but regular feature films. And then he made his final film, 24 Frames, and he died before it was quite completed, and so his son completed it for him after his death. 24 Frames is very much what it sounds like. In this case, it's about 2 hours long, and it consists of 24 sequences. The first one shows a very famous painting, Peter Bruegel's painting Hunters in the Snow. But what happens is then there starts to be movement within the painting, and this was done by Kiarostami working with an animator. And so we have this you know, iconic painting, which shows people in snow and scenes in the distance and that sort of thing. But now there's movement. Some dogs come in and go out. Some things in the distance move. Some people move a little bit, this kind of thing. And then that's the end of the first of the 24 frames. And then we have the second frame and the third frame and the fourth frame up to 24. Each one, except for that first one, is a still photo taken by Kiara Stammi, always in the world of nature, although sometimes shot from indoors through a window, and with animation bringing this still photograph a certain amount, a small amount of subtle movement. And that's what it is. There's almost never people in this movie. It's almost always just animals or trees and the wind blowing and things like that. Occasionally people. The people sometimes are doing destructive things. There are gunshots. Some animals are killed by hunters, this sort of thing. There's a marvelously suspenseful episode where a bird catches a little animal. Excuse me, a tree, a cat. I'm getting confused. A cat catches a bird and you think, oh, this is tragic and the frame's going to end and the bird gets away. So there's little bits of suspense like this, but mainly this is a movie which is pure minimalism and which is an invitation to the viewer to sit there and contemplate and think and just enjoy the sights that can be brought about. And there are sounds too when a gifted photographer engages with the magnificent world of nature and uses tools of animation to add an element that photography alone cannot have. So it's an extraordinary film. Don't be prepared for a lot of excitement because it's not that sort of movie. But if you're in the mood for something which will give you some quiet space in your life to think about things, I think the people who went to that retreat in the Cleanse should have gone to see 24 Frames. This is very much a movie for you. It's Kiara Stammi's last masterpiece. And finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about Love, Cecil, which is a documentary about the marvelous Cecil Beaton. The movie was directed by Lisa Immerdina Vreeland, who has been in the documentary field before. And Cecil Beaton was a marvelous figure. He was a photographer primarily. And he was a photographer who sort of came along in the earlier part of the 20th century and made a real name for himself as a very major photographer of fashion and stuff like that. Years ago, I read and reviewed Hugo Vickers's authorized biography of Cecil Beaton, a marvelous book, which I totally recommend. And it was all about Beaton's rise to fame in the world of photography, and then he eventually moved over into Hollywood movies, which I'll get to in a moment. And throughout the whole earlier part of his life, he was battling this terrible thing because he was very gay, and this was a time when it was literally illegal to be gay in England, which is where he hailed from, and certainly very much frowned upon and de facto illegal in America, too, where he eventually moved for a while. And so it's very much about his struggle with homosexuality, his coming to terms with his homosexuality, and all of that. But mainly that book, like the film, is about his career, and it interweaves his public and private lives in marvelous ways. And that's the movie is not based on the biography, although Vickers does appear in the movie. But it's basically a conventional documentary that I just found it completely enchanting. So again, Beaton came along as a photographer, became a very—he was a photographer right from very, very early life, and he photographed his family and his friends and this and that. And he used to create these phenomenal sort of fantasy settings for them with magnificent lighting and all of this. And eventually, he was able to come up. He was a hopelessly bad student at school, so that never went anywhere. But eventually, he became a professional photographer and really rose in the ranks of fashion photographers and so forth. And after having a very, very career along those lines, a career marked by controversy, by the way. He also was a gifted illustrator and a gifted writer, and he worked a lot for various iterations of Vogue. And I mentioned controversy. Probably the biggest single controversy in his career was for a reason that he himself never understood. In a thing he did for Vogue, he snuck in teensy little letters that you can barely even see, some anti-Semitic references, just a couple of them. And these were spotted and discovered, and he was really drummed out of the world of photography for really, I think, about a year and a half before he finally was able to start to edge his way back in. And he never understood why he did this. He didn't feel any anti-Semitic sentiments. So he had, you know, in its way, a tumultuous life, not only the struggle with homosexuality, which eventually became something he fully accepted about himself, but things like this bizarre controversy. He did get to Hollywood eventually. He was the production designer and costume designer for just a handful of major productions, Gigi in the late 50s, My Fair Lady in the middle 60s. So he had a very successful career, and it continued right till the end. I also want to mention that gay aesthete that he was, very much in the Oscar Wilde tradition, during World War II, he wanted to contribute, and he became a war photographer and went to all kinds of incredibly dangerous places and put himself in the line of fire. So an extraordinary person. And Love, Cecil, this wonderful documentary, tells the story of his professional and private lives with a whole lot of talking heads, but above all, a phenomenal number of his photographs and clips from movies he was involved with. And I just found it a dizzying and marvelous and inspiring achievement. So I cannot too much recommend Love, Cecil, one of the best movies I've seen this year. And that is my somewhat up and down story this week, Jill.
Thank you very much, David Sterrett. Films in Focus, the films The Cleanse, 24 Frames, and Love, Cecil.